A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 23, 2000, in the series Religion, Significant Critique and Fresh Expression, entitled Religion Made on Earth. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 44, verses 9 through 20, Acts 17, verses 22 through 31, and John 1, verses 14 through 18. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Today and for a few weeks subsequently, I want to speak with you about religion in order that we might understand more clearly, perhaps, that in which we are engaged as a worshiping community, that which informs us in our worship, not only, but also as a way of life, the issue of our worship, that we might understand the nature of this phenomenon of religion, which for us is still important. For many people, less important, perhaps, a falling away. And yet, back over the eons of time, religion has been endemic to the human situation. As long as there have been those that we would denominate human, we find traces of religion, the practice of religion. For the practice of religion is really the attempt of the creature to come into relationship with the ultimate reality. Call that ultimate reality what you will. God, the mystery, the sacred, the holy. Think of it in terms that are personal, or think of it in terms of some life force, whatever that may be. And that ultimate mystery has been thought of in all of those ways. As a matter of fact, human beings try to figure out what in the world is going on, who they are, where we've come from, and what will be the issue of our being here. Is there any meaning to it? Is there any purpose? Is that meaning and purpose something that is intrinsic in the process itself, or is that meaning and purpose something that we would bring to it and create in the midst of it? All of those options are open. But as a matter of fact, to be human is to be religious, because to be human is to live in the presence of a mystery. We didn't create ourselves. And we are here by a grace or a fate, and we live and move and have our being, and we live before a mystery that is beyond us, that cannot be comprehended, cannot be fully grasped, is experienced according to the testimony of people down through the ages who have encountered in some concrete experience that ultimate reality that breaks through, or that bubbles up. In any case, to be human is to come at some point to recognize that life has an ultimate ground and source, and to wonder about it. And religion, the religions of the world, are human phenomena that are the consequence of somebody's experience, which gathered around it a community, which developed a cult, a way of worship, liturgy, prayers, hymns, sacraments, rituals of various kinds, and called those who followed that way to a way of life, an ethics, a morality, or what do you have. Religion is a human phenomenon, and what I want to say this morning in this first message is very simple, but if you really hear me, it's very radical. You won't hear it often in church, but I believe that it's simple and it's true, that religion is made on earth, that it is a human construct. It didn't fall ready-made from heaven. There is no absolute religion that has God's stamp on it, as over against all of the other religions that are practiced by the diversity of humankind. All religion is common in this, that it is made on earth, that it is a human construct. If you could buy that, then I wouldn't have to preach anymore. Then we would recognize together that what we have is a story, a way of devotion, and a way of life, which is the consequence of long history, which is the consequence of some who had an encounter with that mystery, told their story, and created that which has become for us the Christian tradition, flowing out of the Jewish tradition, of course, the biblical tradition, we could say. You say, well, isn't it true? Well, is a sunset true? Is a poem true? Of course it's true. It's true in the sense that it puts us in communion with God. It satisfies the hunger of our heart. It elicits from us that which is noblest and best. It gives us a reason for being. It gives us a hope that enables us to go on to tomorrow. Of course it's true. But not in the sense that a chemical formula is true. Not in the sense that the stuff, the hard stuff with which the natural sciences deal is true. Not in the sense of that which is empirically verifiable. Because religion isn't empirically verifiable. It's not the hard data with which, for example, the sciences deal. Religion is a judgment call. Religion is a choice. Religion is a response to a story. It's engagement in worship in a community. It's the following of a way of life. Religion can be good or less good, but not true or false, in the sense in which we deal with true and false in a world marked by the scientific method, empirical investigation, and all of that sort of thing. No, religion is a human construct, and all of them alike are made on earth. And if you could receive that, if that could soak in and permeate the pores of your being, you would have learned a very radical and very important truth this morning. Oh, I suppose you know it, and you've known it for a long time. You wouldn't be hanging around here probably if you didn't know that. But nonetheless, I want to underscore it as we begin a series of contemplating the nature and the function, the practice of religion in the dawning of human consciousness. There were those ultimate questions, the questions which arise because we are human, conscious, self-conscious, conscious of the other, and aware. And the great religious traditions of the world are the consequence of communities gathering around a visionary experience, a founding story. Now the problem is that there is something also intrinsic in our human nature that wants to take that which is valuable and good and helpful and absolutize it and make it an exclusive, the exclusive way, the exclusive truth, dogmatically to assert that that visionary experience that we've had, that insight, that intuitive grasp of things is the only way, is the only possible understanding, is the only door to eternal life. Monotheism, one God, that certainly was a step forward. For to say God, by definition, is to say that ultimate mystery, that ultimate source of things. Finally, there can be God and none other. There's no problem with that. That is an insightful move. The problem is when, as a monotheist, who affirms with some understanding that God can only be one, I claim that that one is the God of my particular religious vision, rather than recognizing that my God concept, my image, is a groping after that ultimate mystery that is beyond every concrete God image. In Babylon, the Jews were in exile and they were losing their grip. And so the prophet, trying to get them to hang on to their God of Israel, writes this taunting, mocking piece in Isaiah 44. Did you catch it as Bob read it? It is full of satire. He says, look how stupid is this idol worship of the Babylonians. A craftsman takes a tree, cuts it in half. Of half the tree, he builds a fire. He warms himself. He cooks his meal. And from the other half, he shapes an image. And then he bows down and worships the image. How stupid can you be? Says the prophet. Not a very nice attitude, you get that? How stupid can you be? The same tree. Part of it for a fire, for a campfire, for a roast. The other part of it for an idol, a block of wood, shaped and formed, bowed down before. How stupid. Oh, really? If the prophet had been honest and fair, he would have known, I suspect he did know, of some of the liturgy of the Babylonian cult. They weren't stupid. They were fully aware that a block of wood shaped into an image was a mediator of the mystery. There are prayers in the Babylonian liturgy that plead for the God of heaven to come down and indwell this image in order that God might have a concrete existence in the midst of the people. Sounds like the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Maybe they knew what John knew when he said, no one has ever seen God, but the only Son has made God clear or revealed God. The prophet was using satire and ridicule because he had this little ragtag band of exiles and he was trying to hold them for Yahweh God. And so that wasn't so dangerous, and it only becomes dangerous when a group manifest that kind of attitude and that kind of spirit, and they get power. If you've got power to enforce your monotheism and your exclusive claim, you can become a very dangerous person. As someone wrote some years ago, history is bound to be bloody, when it's made by people who barely understand themselves, declare that they understand God perfectly and meet other people who think the same, only different. And then you've got all of the violence and all of the hostility and all of the bitterness and that which fuels so much of the unrest in the human family in our day and has always been the case. No, religion is a human construct. It doesn't mean that it's not the mediator of revelation and saving grace. Judaism, well, we believe that Moses was encountered by the living God. But the only way that that could come to be a religious movement was through human language, human articulation, human formulation, human cult, liturgy, prayer, ritual, and commandments, rules, a way of life. Because every religion has those aspects, a story, an experience, an encounter, a vision, which issues in a mode of worship, which issues in a way of life. But you see what I have to say if I would claim that my Christian faith or my Jewish Christian, my biblical tradition is true and true alone and the only truth. What I would have to say then is that Muhammad was just blowing smoke. That what happened to Moses couldn't happen to anybody else. That the Buddha in his moment of enlightenment was not dealing with any ultimate truth or ultimate mystery, any ultimate breakthrough. That all of the great religious traditions that always begin in some founding story, that all the rest of them were false. And mine is true. Well, we've dealt with that often enough here, but it still strikes me in terms of its ignorance and its arrogance. Every religion is made on earth. It doesn't fall out of heaven. If it's a good religion, it puts earthlings in touch with heaven. If it's a good religion, it mediates that mystery whom no one has ever seen. Nor can we know, apart from that gracious unveiling, here and now, there and here and there, now and again. But religion is a human business. They're not all the same. Some are better than others in terms of what they mediate, in terms of what fruit follows. And that can be adjudicated. You can talk about that. But as a matter of fact, what cannot be denied is that all of us humans who are religious are engaged in a system of story, worship, and life, which is a human construct. So how do you judge religion then? Well, let me suggest just a couple of things. Good religion opens the mind. Good religion opens the mind. Easy enough to say, but also indicative of the fact that there's been an awful lot of bad religion, because most religion has not been about opening the mind, but closing the mind, has it not? About the statement of an absolute deposit of faith beyond which one ought not to think. The creation of a box within which one can think all one wants to, as long as one doesn't get out of the box. But good religion will open the mind. Good religion will open us to the reality of this world. It will give us access to all of the sciences and all the data, the explosion of knowledge, which is so amazing in our day. amazing breakthroughs in biology, for example, dealing with the human being, the genome project, for example, the DNR mapping, that kind of thing. We don't need to be threatened by that. A good religion will say to us, go for it, understand it, be fascinated by it, and profit from it. Good religion opens the mind. Good religion will help us to understand our own religion. It will help us to understand the historical conditionedness of every religion. We'll begin to see how they arose, how they developed, where they are, why they are what they are. Without that kind of absolutism that says mine is true and all the rest are false, I'll become to see how I'll go back and read Isaiah 44 and I'll say, prophet, I understand what you were doing in that context, but I don't like your attitude. And you were not fair to Babylonian religion. It'll enable me to say to Paul, who comes to Athens and sees all the temples and all the idols, and it said before the reading started this morning, he was disturbed. Yes, he was disturbed because Paul had this amazing vision. He was gripped by a vision. He believed that all of this imagery and all of these gods and goddesses represented in the city of Athens simply didn't measure up to that which had gripped him and grasped him. He wanted to tell the whole world about the God of Israel who had become incarnate, not in a block of wood, but in a human face. And it's natural, good, and right that he should have shared his vision. As long as he didn't do as the prophet did, and that's denigrate all of those who were groping after the mystery. After all, that's what human religion is, groping after the mystery. Good religion will help us to understand that. Good religion will give us a sense of why things are the way they are. For example, in our house right now, the aroma is marvelous. There's a pork loin roasting. The clan is coming over. They're going to feed at mother's trough. But we didn't invite our Jewish friends. Because of the dietary laws, I wouldn't invite my Jewish friends over for a pork loin. Now, why did the Jews have a restriction against pork or any of the dietary laws? They had a hygienic basis. I suppose they thought pigs were full of trichinitis, and they probably were. And it wasn't healthy. Now, it became a religious thing. But it had a very practical base. But now you tell a pig farmer today that his pork is not the other white meat, he'll be offended. Because, I mean, those pigs, I mean, they're palatial palaces now. Well, then, the dietary law isn't necessary anymore, is it? Not really. But is it okay still not to eat pork? Of course it's okay. But you're not dealing with something that's in the ultimate structure of reality. You're making, that's a choice. I belong to a Jewish community. We have dietary laws so that when I eat, I am reminded of God. When I eat, the very way I eat, the things I eat, the things I don't eat, remind me that I am a child of God. The God of Israel is my God. That's fine. That's good. Or maybe something we can identify with a little more. The Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath, what a wonderful institution. I commend it to you. I commend it to myself, for whom every weekend is shot to heaven. But I heard on the news last night that at Camp David yesterday, the conversations between Barak and Arafat were casual. Why? Because it was a Sabbath. Now, who knows what they really did in the bushes, but for the face of the world, Sabbath was observed. Is that good? Sure is good. Does it reflect something in the ultimate structure of things? No. The problem is, you see, if everybody really was as observant as the Jew, and you're an American Christian's trying to get an Arab and a Jew together, you got the Arab Sabbath on Friday and the Christian Sabbath on Sunday. You got Friday, Saturday, and Sunday wrapped, you know, just written right out. You can't get anything done. On the other hand, if 3 days were spent by our world leaders in the contemplation of creation and God, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday might be more profitable. But is it something that's in the ultimate structure of things? No. Is it a fruitful, helpful choice? Absolutely. Good for all of us to observe Sabbath. Not because that's the way reality is, but because that reality constructed by us is a very good way to be. Good religion will help me to understand those things so that I know that a lot of the things I do are arbitrary. They're judgment calls on my part, and the thing I have to be satisfied with is whether or not it's a means by which I am introduced, I am in communion with, I am in touch with that ultimate mystery. Is it a way that's fruitful in my life? If it's good for me, does it have to be good for you? If something else is good for you, do I have to deny that that can be a means of grace for you? No, not at all. Because religion is made on earth and it's a human construct, and the point is that it be faithful and fruitful in mediating to us that ultimate mystery that embraces us and undergirds us and overshadows us and gives us life as gift and hope for the future. And then good religion will lead to compassion. I'm reading Karen Armstrong's Battle for God. Incidentally, I talked to her in London last week. She's going to come here October 2001. And she stresses again, as she stressed in her History of God, how all the great religious traditions call to compassion. Good religion will warm the heart. It'll open the mind and it'll warm the heart. And it will result in a compassionate people. And there, a lot of good religion has a pretty bad track record. And we still haven't been able to master that one. Did you see the ABC Evening News at 6:30 last night? I perked up my ears when they said there was a religious problem somewhere in the country. Well, it happened to be in Chicago, in a suburb in Palos Heights. And on the news screen, you get the story of this Muslim community that's outgrown their facility, and so they were going to buy a church building that was for sale in Palos Heights. And on the screen comes the Palos Heights Reformed Church. I spoke there a few years ago. They haven't asked me back lately. But the Muslim congregation was going to buy the building until there was this uproar in this suburb of Chicago that's filled with many, many Christian people. And so the village council offered the Muslim community $200,000 to walk away, just get out of here. And they were going to do it until, bless his heart, the mayor said, number one, you say you're going to use that for a recreational facility. A year ago, you turned it down because it wasn't large enough. Number two, we don't have $200,000 just to pay out. And number three, the reason you're doing it's wrong. Right down the lake, folks. It's not just a religious thing, it's a human thing. It's the fear of the other. It's the threat of that which is different. Good religion will break through to us where we say, yet cannot be. The world cannot continue in all of the intimacy of the human community to live with that kind of paranoia, that kind of divisiveness, that kind of fear of diversity. Good religion will result in compassion, or it's not worth anything it claims to be. And I'll quit now, but I could go on one more and say, good religion will elevate the aesthetic tastes. Because there was a day when the church was the womb of the arts. The magnificent architecture, the beautiful paintings, the lovely music that moves the soul. All of that comes out of the spiritual center that is elevated by the encounter with God. And I look around today and I see such a terrible loss of the aesthetic sense in the deterioration of religion. Well, that's another subject. Friends, to be ultimately committed to one's faith and vision does not necessitate the claim that it fell out of heaven. To be totally committed and deeply nurtured in one's faith vision does not necessitate the denial that it's a human construct flowing out of a human experience of God, winning its way through liturgy, prayers, and an effective way of human being. But to acknowledge that religion is made on earth is to be able to join hands and hearts and arms with all God's children. For good religion will understand itself and feel compassion for the other.